Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Reclaimed. This is the podcast where we critically claim things twice. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. And we are visiting one of the more celebrated directors of his generation.
Indeed. This is a big day, and it's a big movie. It's a prominent film from the 1990s. If anyone is new to Critically Reclaimed, here's how this podcast works. We have a Patreon over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, and anyone who contributes at any tier, even $1 a month, gets to vote for every episode of Critically Reclaimed. We pick a streaming service. We pick four catalog titles on that streaming service, at least two of which Whitney has never seen, and at least two of which I have never seen, and we let our patrons vote for what we're going to watch. And this time, we decided to look at the many, 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 many great offerings over at Criterion, of which there are many.
Many, in fact.
And, we decided to go with Chungking Express, let's just play the clip.
On the streets of Hong Kong, a mysterious woman, a young cop, and an innocent dreamer are about to meet, where mystery and romance collide. Miramax Films and Rolling Thunder Pictures present Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express.
Usually I try to do a bit more of an intro than that, but that's fine.
Chungking Express, was a bit of a big deal when it came out in the mid-90s. This was celebrated by my boss. To the point that is, I still am technically in the employ of Quentin Tarantino. I don't work there very often, but I go in like maybe once a month now. Yeah. So I'm still employed by Quentin Tarantino. I still can't comment on his films.
Hold on a second, you dropped this name.
That's context, all right?
I know
this is a legit caveat. So
no, in fact, it's actually been the bane of our existence on more than one occasion, because Quentin Tarantino is one of the most prominent filmmakers of his generation, and Whitney isn't allowed to talk about him.
I'm not allowed. I can say like objective things,
factual accuracy. Second film was.
Yeah, I can say that the Pulp Fiction was his second film, and that it made a certain amount of money, or that it was popular,
or that it won these Oscars, or whatever.
Yeah, like those kinds of things, I can talk to, but I can't say my opinion of these things. I can't say whether I liked them or not.
But when Quentin Tarantino emerged in the 90s, this is the interesting thing about Quentin Tarantino is, in the 70s, we had like sort of the film school filmmaker generation where
your Coppola, Spielberg, Scorsese's,
all of a sudden there was a new influx of filmmakers who had studied film, not from within the industry, like through apprenticeships, scholarly study.
And in a college.
And indeed, that did have some impact on the way that they viewed cinema and the way that the types of films that they made and the way that those films interacted with and inspired others. Quentin Tarantino was part of the first generation of filmmakers who grew up with video stores. Mm. That was their education. And we started seeing filmmakers like Richard Linklater, Steven Soderbergh, Kevin Smith, a lot of indie darlings.
Another echo of, of Breathless, and we'll get to Breathless in a second.
We kind of have to talk about that too. But so when Quentin Tarantino emerged as a prominent filmmaker with Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, he became the video store guy who became a filmmaker, and indeed, he still does this to this day. Anytime you hear him in an interview, he is rattling off movies, often obscure or niche or underappreciated movies, that have directly inspired him in ways that people might not have predicted, or stuff that he really wants you to see. And indeed, the movie theater where Whitney works is a movie theater that was a long-running, independent, sort of retrospective movie theater in Los Angeles. And when that was going under, Quentin Tarantino bought it and made it his own, basically his own private repertory theater.
Yeah.
Except it's free to all. Well, not free, but it's available to all to buy tickets and go see any movie Quentin Tarantino feels like showing.
Yeah, the story of the New Beverly is Sherman Torgan was the guy who was running it for many, many years, and when he passed away, the theater sort of fell on hard times, and it was struggling a little bit, and Quentin was a big fan of the theater. He stepped in, and he bought it. He was just going to be the landlord, and the people who ran it were just going to keep on running it. Story goes that somebody bought a digital projector to install in it so they could show newer movies at the New Beverly, and Quentin didn't like that.
He's a diehard film enthusiast.
Physical celluloid nut. And so At the New Beverly, we only show 35 and 16 millimeter prints and nothing else.
Yeah.
If there was room in that booth for a 70 millimeter projector, I'm sure he'd put one in there. But
sure he would.
But no digital. That was a mandate.
Yeah.
So yeah, he has a very specific idea of how he wants his films to be shown at his theater, and it's his theater, so he gets to make that call. And a lot of the films we show there are his.
Yeah. So Quentin Tarantino, a big part of his brand as a filmmaker and as a presence in the entertainment industry, has been someone who is really big on introducing audiences to older or at least more obscure films that otherwise might have been aware.
Or just his favorite
movies. But typically he's not the most mainstream in when it comes to his taste. So a lot of his favorite movies are relatively obscure to the mainstream here in America. And shortly after he started becoming, you know, an Academy Award winning filmmaker, he started working very intensely with Miramax, and he actually ended up getting his own releasing company, which was specifically created so that he could release into theaters whatever he kind of fucking AWOL felt like. And the arguably, or what has been said to be the film that made him want to do this, was the film we're talking about today, which is Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express, which had already come out overseas, but had not made it to America. Mm-hmm. In the 90s and prior, international films came to America with... typically, they seemed to only come to America if there was a general consensus amongst the distributors that there was American appeal. Well, this is the kind of movies Americans wanted to see, which meant that there was a lot of stuff that just never came here.
The history of international film distribution in the United States is wide and varied. And I here's another name I just dropped. I used to intern for Roger Corman back in the early 2000s when I was fresh out of college. Mm-hmm. And Roger Corman... He was a businessman far more so than he was a filmmaker. Like He made some good movies, and he's passionate about film, but he understood that it was a good business to make money in, and that's how he kind of figured. He would make a lot of movies for super cheap, pre-sell them, and then even if no one saw them, he would make money off of these things. So a lot and a good way to sort of scoop up a lot of, we'd call it content now, he just scoop up all of these like international hits, like Ingmar Bergman movies and Fellini movies, and distribute them in American theaters. Cost him almost nothing.
Yeah.
And the art house crowd would flock to these things. So because of this schlockmeister, Roger Corman, a lot of these really classy foreign movies were getting, or international films were being played in American cinemas. Fast forward a generation or so, and I think it might have been the popularity of Pulp Fiction and Quentin Tarantino that a lot of sort of a new generation of Asian cinema started making its way over to the United States because he was a big fan of Hong Kong films.
Yeah, these are as you might have seen with Kill Bill, he's a big fan of Hong Kong kung fu films like the Shaw Brothers or Golden Harvest. There was also this giant wave in the 80s and 90s in particular of this new breed of crime cinema that was coming out of Hong Kong that was kind of influenced by what American gangster pictures were doing, somewhat influenced by what European gangster pictures were doing, films like Le Samurai or films like Mean Streets, lots of stories about masculinity in a world of violence. But there was also all of a sudden this injection of operatic violence. So imagine Mean Streets, but with a lot of slow-mo shootouts. Well, that was stuff like A Better Tomorrow. That was what John Woo was doing. And
John Woo was like right at the forefront of this movie.
Very much so. But he was not alone. There were a lot of other contemporaries who were doing similar work. Choi Hark, Ringo Lam. But these movies were starting to get noticed on home video. Oftentimes in home video releases without a lot of care taken to them. They were pan and scan. Oftentimes they were dubbed badly. They weren't necessarily getting major theatrical releases. And so there was definitely a cult that was starting to build and notice these, of which Quentin Tarantino was one of the people at the forefront. But they weren't necessarily all getting major theatrical distribution. And one such crime saga... which is an odd sort of description for it, since it's also intensely romantic, is Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express, which is a film that is actually two stories, indirectly connected by location, where basically it's two cops and sad love stories.
And the women they love.
One is a cop who inadvertently falls in love with a woman who is involved in organized crime, and another one is a cop who is so hung up on a flight attendant who just left him that he doesn't notice that the woman who works at this hole-in-the-wall eatery is desperately in love with him and has actually started breaking into his apartment in order to clean up his life. And he's so self-absorbed, he doesn't even notice it.
those are the two love stories. One of them is good.
Oh, you only like one of them?
Yeah, I'm coming to the conclusion more and more that Wong Kar-wai is just not my bag.
Interesting. Okay.
I've seen a couple. I really like his film Days of Being Wild.
I haven't seen that one.
And I really like his film Happy Together.
Okay.
Those are the two Wong Kar-wai films that I can just recommend wholeheartedly.
As much as I like the Wong Kar-wai films I've seen, there I have a lot of gaps.
Okay.
I have a lot of gaps.
His film In the Mood for Love is often on the top of lists of the the best movies ever made.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that one that much. I know that that's going to get me into a lot of trouble in a lot of critical circles, because that is a deeply beloved movie.
I have not revisited it in a while, though. Mm-hmm. I have argued that it is the only movie that critics are legally allowed to call aching.
Aching
is a movie critics like to whip out a lot, and I'm like, no, we only In the Mood for Love. That's the only film we're allowed to call aching.
Aching is another... Yeah.
Or achingly, that adverb only allowed to be attributed to something you're saying about In the Mood for Love.
In the case of achingly, in the case of In the Mood for Love is also code for it, not a damn thing happens.
Oh, stop it.
Look...
It is a simmering
looks great
kettle.
In that dress, and her hair
is
wonderful.
It is a simmering
it's
kettle of passion that is never allowed to boil over.
It's like 30 perfume commercials strung together. It's great looking.
In the Mood for Love, if you've never seen it, I like it when he does. I haven't seen it in a while, though. Maybe it's aged badly, but... it is a story of a man and a woman who they're both married, and they find out that their spouses are having an affair together, and they start sort of bonding over that, and then they start feeling things for each other, and they're not sure if they want to have an affair together, and if so, does that make them as bad as the people that they're mad at, and so they're very conflicted.
Yeah, and they communicate that by sitting in diners and looking at each other and not saying anything.
I feel a lot, to be fair, I feel very similarly about a lot of French New Wave films that you like.
That's true. And you know what? That's fair. And speaking of French New Wave, let's bring up Breathless, because Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless is... Chungking Express is essentially a remake of Breathless, especially...
It's got similarities. They're definitely of the same ilk.
I feel like that first story especially, which is the cop who's involved with the drug runner.
Yeah.
That feels a lot like Breathless to me, where there's like a lot of hanging out, and the way he's been measuring time is through the expiration dates on canned foods.
Okay, so this is weird, and I think it requires
this is
a little
kind of
setup.
Like a little bit of a quirky thing, and I found this to be really amusing.
The setup for the first chapter in Chungking Express, which is a two-chapter movie, is there is a young and very sexy cop. He is played by, hold on, I want to make sure I get his name right, Takeshi Kaneshiro. Who's been in everything. He's great. He has recently been dumped by the girl he's deeply in love with. And he keeps expecting her to come back. He keeps calling everyone he knows. It's like, oh, hey, we haven't spoken in a few years. Did my ex-girlfriend leave a message for me? Like, that kind of thing. It's really kind of sad.
He's measuring the passage of time.
Yeah.
But she's going to come back after X amount of time. Like, he's convinced himself.
He's given her a month. In 1 month, she's going to come back. And he has decided that every day during that month, he's going to buy... This is so quirky, you want to slap him. He's going to buy a can of pineapple. Like, Dole pineapple. And he's going
syrup,
And he's going to get a can that expires... on May 1st. Like, he broke up with him on April 1st. It's going to expire. He's going to get these cans and they expire on May 1st. And every day he gets one. And after a month, when she has not successfully come back to him, and on the last day, he's having a freak out at the local convenience store because they got rid of all the old cans of pineapple. It's like, they're still good for one more day! He gets drunk and eats all the pineapple. Which is such a... fucking lovelorn teenager thing to do. The men in this movie are absolute emotional children.
Yeah, they're both
romantic and sad.
They're both pretty pathetic. Counting down expiration dates on cans. You know, I'm not sure if you've ever gone through like a really bad breakup where you actually start delving into strange details around you just to sort of keep your mind occupied with something.
Yeah, sure. It's a common thing, like especially your first romance or two.
I had a really, really bad breakup once, and for whatever reason, I got really into Radio Disney at that time. that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I can sing you all the lyrics from Hey Juliet by Element.
I remember one time I had I would just do nothing but listen to different sad covers of Radiohead's Creep. just sing along. Yeah. But I'm a creep. I'm a weirdo.
This is my favorite mix. It's nothing but versions of Creep.
What the hell am I doing here?
I don't belong here.
I don't belong here. I don't belong here.
There is something, and not only is that like really adolescent, but that's also like really of the era. That's something you'd see a lot in the 90s, these weird kind of aching romances.
not in the mood for love, you're not allowed.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. This is proto-aching. This is proto-aching. He hadn't been in the mood for love yet.
That kind of proto-aching. Thank you. That, you know, like young hipster coffee shop 90s poets would do. Like these trying to delve into sort of the deep meaning of the very commonplace. That was an aesthetic trend at the time.
Yeah.
So it feels very much of the era, and because I was around at that time, it did sort of like hit a little bit of a nostalgic note for me.
Fair enough. The plot though
and everybody's like so stylish, and that's the part of the movie where things are really moving along. It is just this guy kind of mourning and getting like cans, but he's bickering with people. There's a lot of different characters. Yeah. He's going through this weird journey. People don't quite understand him. Yeah. And
the
drug runner is actually like going through a lot of these dramatic things where she's selling drugs and auctioning things off.
The drug runner is played by Bridget Lynn. She's got this fabulous blonde hairdo. She's wearing sunglasses at night. Very stylized. Very more De Palma than anything else.
Well, and that's why I wanted to compare this to Breathless.
It's all style over practicality.
And that these characters are clearly emulating their own selves after what they've seen in the movies, which is kind of the whole theme of Breathless.
Yeah. No, she's engaged in helping a group of men smuggle drugs through customs at some airport, and they all vanish. They're like they just steal the drugs. I don't know why I've never seen drug mules do that before. So they're like, well, I've got the drugs. Why don't I just take them? And so she's in trouble with the guy who she works for, and if she doesn't find the drugs within like, then he gets she has an expiration date as well. If you don't find the drugs by then, he's gonna kill her. The expiration date on the guy's love affair and the expiration date on her life happen to be the same night, and they both decide to get really depressed and drunk in a bar. And so they end up just sort of being drunk and sad and cool, like next to each other and like smoking cigarettes and drinking cool looking booze. And like, that's it. And that's like that's the biggest love affair of their lives. They didn't even kiss. It's like, and they're both never going to forget this because at the end of it all, this changes this cop's life. And then she ends up killing the guy who's going to kill her and presumably goes off and becomes either a fugitive or perhaps a new drug kingpin. I don't know. Or both.
I assumed a few, like she'll just vanish. And that's the tragedy of that romance.
And that's a good, is that the one you liked or is that the one you didn't
like? That's the one I liked.
That's the one you liked. Yeah. Okay. The second romance, and this is the one I like more. Yeah, I like the first one. I like the first one too, but this is the other one is one I like more. It stars Tony Leung, who if you're new to Chinese cinema, you might know him from.
If you're new,
well, like you might know him from Shang-Chi. He was the bad guy in Shang-Chi, but he's also been one of the best actors in the world for like the last 35 years.
He has like 400 credits.
Yeah, and he's amazing in almost everything. He's in The Mood for Love. He's done some John Woo films as well. He's incredible. Please seek out everything he does. He's a genius. He plays a cop. Again, he was dating a flight attendant. She only came to town when she was in town. And she dumped him.
It wasn't like a serious thing. It was like, he was clearly in love with her. She was just having a regular fling with this guy.
Yeah, so he's absolutely devastated. He would go to the same late night hole-in-the-wall eatery. He would get her the same thing every single night. And then one day, the guy who works there says, what if you get her something different? And he's like, well, I don't know. She seems to like this. And he comes back the next day. Yeah, she wanted options. So he ends up getting her different foods. And then eventually, she realized that she wanted options for the man she was dating, too. And now he's super sad. And the young woman who works there, played by Faye Wong, is absolutely enamored of this devastatingly handsome, romantic, sad sack cop.
The Fei Wong character is the primordial stew from which Manic Pixie Dream Girls evolved.
Yeah, I feel like this one was sincere, though.
She's got, you know, sort of like the wild, unconventional haircuts, like, cut really short.
Yeah.
She dresses kind of weird, and she has all these quirks. She likes listening to California Dreamin'.
Yeah, old 50s and 60s rock.
Mostly California Dreamin'.
They repeat that one a lot, but there are other songs they play, too.
And she likes to play it so loud you can barely hear her speaking.
Yeah.
And on the soundtrack, we also hear... The Cranberries, was it
Dreams?
The Cranberries, Dreams,
which is covered by that actress, Fei Wong.
Fei Wong, she was a pop star as well, so she sings great cover in Chinese.
Great cover.
I mean, again, nostalgia, child of the 90s.
But that's also a good cover of that. That's a good song, and that's a good cover of that.
And she emulates the Cranberries lead singer. In fact,
this is one of the movies that I think helped solidify that song in the pop culture firmament. It was a hit song, but there were a lot of hit songs in the 90s. I think this was one of those times where it was used in a new context. And a lot of people will associate it now with Chungking Express.
I just knew the song. So that one plays on the soundtrack a lot as well.
Yeah.
She sneaks into his apartment and does quirky things like fix it up. And
To be fair, she doesn't just break in.
Well, he's a sad sack
who
doesn't notice that this girl's in love with him.
Uh-huh.
He's just like, he needs to be picked up, right? That's his story. Because he's depressed and he's lovelorn.
Yeah.
And this energetic young thing with all these quirks comes in and tries to fix him up, and that's a Manic Pixie Dream Girl story.
I get that, but here's what I'm going to say about that, though, because I see your point, and you're not wrong, but I want to consider this.
But I am reductive, you see.
I wouldn't even say reductive. I would just say your angle is a little skewed. Because I would argue that the Manic Pixie Dream Girl which is a trope that I believe was codified after the movie. Was it Elizabethtown or Garden State? They both came out around the same time.
It's the same movie.
Well, I'm trying to remember. But it was codified for one of those movies.
I think it was Garden State, actually. Okay. The Natalie Portman character.
But around the same time, there were a couple of indie movies that had a very similar premise, which is, here's a sad dork, and he gets...
The origin critic of that phrase. Came up with that phrase.
Here's a sad dork whose life is... rather drab, and he's in a rut, and then he meets a female character who is exciting, energetic, interested in weird stuff. Yes,
it was Nathan Rabin, and he actually did coin it in reference to Elizabethtown.
It was Elizabethtown. Yeah. Garden State and Elizabethtown came out at similar times, so I see how I did that. But both Garden State and Elizabethtown are the same thing. They're stories about sad men whose lives aren't going the way they want, and then they run into an extremely energetic, eclectic, quirky woman who, from a narrative perspective, only seems to exist for them. I exist in order to get you out of your rut. I'm like some magical being that was called forth to help, you know, Aladdin get the princess, that kind of thing.
She is divinely sent to fix your life.
Essentially, yes. I would argue she has no
real agency of her own.
Yeah.
She has no dreams of her own.
Right.
She's not going to do anything to shake up your complacency that has anything to do with... That doesn't have anything to do with fixing you.
Agreed. And I understand that. However, I would argue that's not quite Fei and Chungking Express. That trope had not been codified yet. And although Fei is definitely part of the DNA of it, and I'm certain... I'm sure that Zach Braff and or Cameron Crowe, who did Garden State and Elizabethtown, one or both of them, I'm sure, saw Chungking Express. I'm sure at some point in their heads, a character like Fei was part of this idea. But this goes back even further. One could argue that that's true of Katharine Hepburn and Bringing Up Baby as well. So it goes back further. But I would argue that Fei does not only exist to help Tony Leung out, because Tony Leung never finds out she did any of that. It is not about her being there for them. It is about her insinuating herself into this guy's world for her own weird, creepy gratification. She is weird and creepy about this. She gets the flight attendant leaves a message. She knows where the fucker lives. She could slide it under the door. Instead, she leaves a message at the restaurant where he goes. And the message is a Dear John letter, and it includes the house keys. And Fei is going to give it back to Tony Leung, and Tony Leung figures out that it's a Dear John letter and says, I don't want it. And so every single person at the restaurant has already read it. They know the keys are in it. She decides she's going to go break into this motherfucker's house because it gives her a weird thrill. And then it also gives her a weird thrill to do things like tidy up and replace his stuffed animals. It's add more fish to his fish tank. She's fucking with him. Now, granted, I don't think she's fucking with him in a way to try to scare him. Mm. I think she's just doing this to just be kind of weird. This is for her. She's doing this for her to be kind of manipulative because she's attracted to him. She's in love with him. But she doesn't have a healthy way of doing it. Mm. I would actually argue that this is not that romantic. It's actually kind of bizarre. Unable to connect because they can't.
I don't think it's romantic, and I don't think this is about I guess it is about a lack of connection, but yeah. I don't think she's doing it for her own edification. I think she's doing it to try to help him out because she's attracted to him.
I think that's what she thinks she's doing, and indeed on a surface level she is, because she's cleaning his apartment.
Yeah.
Because she's, you know, doing little things, but she's not actually engaging him in a meaningful way to change his life. She's just doing little things around the house.
She's doing
that's not actually fixing him.
It doesn't matter if she actually is doing it. That she's trying. She's doing her quirk attack to try to help him out.
But I would argue that it's not actually helping him out if he doesn't know she's doing it. It's just this weird thing happening in his house.
It doesn't matter if it's actually working.
It's like you don't know your house is haunted. It's still haunted.
Yeah.
But the ghost isn't necessarily trying to do anything to you. And I would argue that she's definitely into him, and this is her way of expressing affection without ever actually telling him anything. Mm. And that is a weird form of selfishness. And I would argue that that is odd, and it's kind of fantastical in the way that it is presented, but I don't really feel it's as Manic Pixie Dream Girl as a lot of those later versions are, because it's more about what she wants and how she's incapable of. She could just tell this guy she's into him at any time, and then he might say cool. And indeed, the couple of times they run into each other, there's this weird bit where he runs into her at his apartment complex, not realizing that she had just broken in. And he invites her over, and they just hang out for a little bit. Mm. And he says, hey, you want to listen to this CD my ex-girlfriend left me? And she says, sure, that's great. Not realizing that it's a CD she left. He's so absolutely out of it that he can't imagine anything in his life didn't have something to do with this other woman. And she lets him continue with that fantasy. It concludes with him finally realizing what has happened, actually asking her out, and then her getting total cold feet and running away. And she leaves him a note, and he leaves it out in the rain. It's like, oh, another one of these. But then he can't help himself, and he reads it. And it was information about where to meet in 1 year, but it was raining, and all the ink ran. And so that's kind of almost where it ends. And then a year later, she shows up, and she goes to visit. It was her cousin's shop, and the cousin's shop is now being run by Tony Leung. He decided to quit being a cop because he wasn't doing much good as a cop, so he might as well run a restaurant. That ending was changed on the fly. This movie was shot over the course of 3 weeks, while another Wong Kar-wai film, Ashes of Time, was on hiatus. They'd already started shooting it, and he just needed something to make.
Yeah,
in this chunk of time. And so he would write the scenes like the day before he shot them. It was all stuff that he could do on a low budget. And the original idea was there was going to be this big sort of, it's my understanding, this kind of Hollywood ending where they met at the airport and it was kind of romantic. And then they couldn't get an airport. So they had to find some cheap-ass way to do this.
I'm glad they didn't find an airport, because that would have made it a lot worse.
I think this is a much better ending. Mm-hmm. It's still, listen, I'm not going to pretend that the second story in Chungking Express isn't twee. Of course,
yeah,
it's tween.
I'm not pretending it's not tween. I think that the tweeness is what's kind of turning me off a little bit.
And I can appreciate that. I don't mind a little twee, and I actually think that there's just enough character and sadness in these people that it doesn't feel like just cutesy. It feels like just odd people who, they're just too odd for their own damn good, and they can't quite get out of their own way.
This might be a strange comparison, but the characters remind me in a way of the characters from a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah, I can see that. Especially the second one.
If you look at the Wes Anderson characters, like the kinds of characters he writes, they are slaves to their own passion.
Yeah.
They need to dress as neatly as possible. Mm-hmm. They need to be color coordinated. They're just
constantly trying to control the world around them.
They're driven by this like kind of obsessive compulsive almost drives to be as sort of like in these little dioramas that Wes Anderson likes to film.
Yeah, they're safe
and,
that way.
And when somebody approaches them, they never interact with people outside of their own comfort zone. They always use their own language to communicate with people. I feel like these people in Chungking Express are also similarly trapped within their own neuroses, obsessions, version of the world that they've imagined around them.
Right.
And it's, you know, about those bubbles kind of bumping into one another.
Right.
Inside those bubbles, they're very much affected by movie characters. So I'm going to bring it back around to Breathless again.
Sure.
All of these characters are taking a lot of their behaviors and their romantic cues from art. They're emulating what they've seen on screens. Movies don't play a big part in this movie, but I feel like Chungking Express is going to play better for people who know a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. This is
the style is the substance.
Exactly. You brought it up at the head here that this is made by a filmmaker who was raised on the filmmakers who were raised on film school.
Yeah.
This is like a generation hence. So this is like another copy of a copy, and that's what this kind of film looks like. Mm. There's something kind of exciting about that.
Sure.
You get to see sort of a new evolution kind of come to the fore, and that was happening a lot in the 1990s. You can see a lot of like what Wong Kar-wai is getting at, what cinematic sources he's quoting a lot.
Yeah.
He's not borrowing exact shots, but he's taking a lot of the attitudes.
Yeah.
And I feel like it works some of the time, but in that second half of the story, it does start to kind of go a little long in the tooth.
The second story, I feel, I'm not sure, I didn't count. I think the second story is meaningfully longer than the first.
Yeah, I think it's like one third and two thirds. And I feel like if it were half and half,
probably be
or if he added a third story, it would have been a little bit better.
Well, you know, originally there was going to be a third story, and then that story he decided was strong enough to handle on its own, and it ended up becoming his film Fallen Angels.
Okay.
In 1995, which is about a hitman who falls in love.
Oh, okay.
And it also stars Takeshi Kaneshiro.
I wish he had done it.
Well, he did. He made it into another movie.
Just had made it into sort of a proper triptych.
Maybe you'd like Fallen Angels. I haven't seen Fallen Angels.
Yeah, maybe
you'd like
it. I don't know. Yeah, I haven't. I'm a little underwatched on my Wong Kar-wai, so maybe that's why I'm not sort of on his same wavelength yet. But I think when he's doing something like Days of Being Wild or Happy Together, I'm feeling those movies a little bit more for their like punk rock outsider qualities.
Yeah.
Rather than something like this, which feels a little bit more. It doesn't make it a bad film, by the way. I actually do like this movie, but it feels a little more like an affect in this than it has in the other films.
I think this movie is about affect, though, and I think that's something
absolutely
that,
it is, but that also can be a mite alienating.
Perhaps, but I actually think what this movie, to me, how this movie connects, is that it's about affect, but it's also about peeling away what's underneath that affect. So what is this story really? This is a story about two cops. Mm. This is a cop movie. Do they do any cop stuff? There's like one shot of Takeshi Kaneshiro like chasing a guy, but it's not important to the plot. It doesn't connect to anything. Donnie Leung does nothing. He eats. He goes home, he's sad, and he goes out and he eats. They do no cop stuff. There's a criminal, the cop interacts with the criminal. There's no cat and mouse to it. It's completely irrelevant. And I feel like what Wong Kar-wai is doing here, and it's something that I mentioned before, other filmmakers were doing in Hong Kong, there was a dissection of machismo that was emerging in this era. It had already done so by the time Chungking Express came out in 1994, but the macho action films that I think were really breaking out of the Hong Kong cinema scene at this time. And there are a lot more that were just far more just conventionally gung-ho guns kind of thing. But the ones that tended to break out and have a huge influence are the ones that weren't just brainless crime movies, and they're actually deeply rooted in the inner worlds of these larger-than-life caricatures that were populating the screen. If you look at something like The Killer, John Woo's breakout movie, it stars Chow Yun-fat as this absolutely beautiful, slick, sexy hitman. And in the course of the opening amazing shootout, he accidentally blinds a nightclub singer who just happened to be there, did nothing to do with anything, wasn't guilty of anything. And so he decides to dedicate everything he's doing to saving up enough money to get her, like, a cornea transplant to right his wrongs. And he ends up destroying everything just out of guilt and love. And there's sequences in the end, like, hard-boiled, where, like, the bad guy doesn't just have the hero at gunpoint. He has him, like, slap himself in the face and yell that he's impotent in front of everybody. Like, these are movies about sort of tearing down the male facade. And when you look at something like Chungking Express, which is ostensibly a crime movie, which is ostensibly a cop movie, what is it actually about? Dudes are sad. This is, like, Wong Kar-wai's image of masculinity in this universe is sad romance dudes. They're just sad, pathetic, lonely hearts. And the women around them have much more interesting worlds. They're doing much more interesting things. They're career-minded. They're exploring. They're eccentric and have actual tastes and interests. Tony Leung is interested in nothing. At least Faye likes music. At least she's got some kind of outlet. Like, these are just shells of men. And they're living for these women because women are much more interesting than these facades of men that we're seeing in a lot of these things. And what does Wong Kar-wai think they're filled with? Sadness. What would a typical cop in a cop movie be? Lonely. And I find that to be about the facade, but I think there's something kind of sweet about the way Wong Kar-wai views that facade, as opposed to just, you know, oh, like in Breathless, what's the name of it? Is it
Belmondo.
Belmondo. Yeah. In Breathless, Belmondo, I don't feel like his adherence to cinematic style and the cool that he wants to extrapolate from Hollywood movies comes from a place of, like, a pure soul.
No.
Yeah, it's much more cynical about it, I think, than this movie.
Belmondo's character in Breathless is kind of a pathetic figure.
Yeah.
He is so devoted to sort of the cool of crime that he doesn't realize that real death is involved in this. And he's actually just sort of inviting real-world death when he only knows cinema death.
Right. And I feel like that's jump on Belmondo, if he was in Chungking Express, this would be a very different movie. And instead, we've got these incredibly sexy, hunky cops who are all style. We've got a criminal, drug runner who looks right out of a De Palma movie. And what are they filled with romance? It's a different vibe.
I appreciate that. I appreciate everything you said about sort of this deconstruction of masculinity, especially as it was going in concurrent Hong Kong cinema. And I see where Wong Kar-wai was going with his men. And I see where he was going with the woman in the blonde wig, because she actually had a little bit of agency and she was moving through this world a lot. And she actually was, I feel like, in control of her life. And one of a repeated line of dialogue is that they came within 0.01 centimeters of each other. Like, they almost touched. They came in really close. And that was, like, just sharing that space for a brief moment was enough to sort of get their hearts to lock. And in the world of this cop who's supposed to be moving fast but has slowed down, and this drug runner who has to keep on moving, I feel like there's a little bit of a balance. There's, like, a poetry between those two characters.
Yeah, I see why you like that one better.
And I feel with the other one, though, we get to know Tony Leung really well. We get to sort of see his longing, his aching longing.
Proto-aching.
But I feel like the Fei Wong character is incredibly inscrutable. Like, I don't know what her goal is here. I don't sense a lot of agency for her. And that's why I keep on referring to her as a Manic Pixie Dream Girl. I don't see, like, she's clearly into this guy. But beyond that, you know, and she listens to music, but she does seem to be a lot of, like, just a collection of artifice. And as such, she's not really emerging as a character in the same way some of the other people are in this movie.
I think what Fei Wong's character kind of represents is this aspect in a lot of people of, there's someone that you have feelings for. And a lot of people, and I've been guilty of this many times, are not comfortable expressing those feelings because there's a danger there. You're exposing yourself. You're, you know, being vulnerable. You leave yourself open to being, let down by even just circumstance. And yet, she doesn't let it get in the way of her being a part of his life. And I think there's something kind of weirdly affectionate about that. I think that is actually what she's doing. She is being as actively uninvolved with his life as she possibly can be. She's not actually saying anything outright, but she is absolutely infecting his life.
Trying
with her
to
presence.
Be in his life without talking to him, essentially. Yeah.
And there's something, I'm sorry, I think there's something kind of like weirdly old-fashioned romantic about that. Like if this were like a tragic poem from the 1800s, where like, you know, this woman like
they're
broke into this man's house.
They just can't say anything.
Yeah, you know, like
other,
that it's a kind of a different kind of passion, but you put it in a modern context, it feels totally different. The one thing I kept thinking of, and this is all totally new context, would never have come up individually, and I don't even know if this is the case, but I wonder if there's a connection here. Drive My Car. Drive My Car movie came out last year.
Ryusuke Hamaguchi.
Yeah, amazing motion picture, and it is about a man who is a theater director, and he's married to an actress, and she is also like writing, and she writes stories, and she wakes him up in the middle of the night, and if he remembers them, they're good enough to write down and put in their stories. The story that she's telling him over the course of Drive My Car is the story of a young woman who keeps breaking into a guy's house because she's infatuated with him and doing little things, leaving pieces of herself, changing things around without him knowing. And I can't help but wonder if I'm sure he probably has seen Chungking Express, but maybe he hasn't, I don't know. But like, is this an intentional call out? Is that something
I didn't put that together, but
it's pretty similar.
It's entirely possible.
This guy isn't a cop in that story, but the actual nuts and bolts of the tale are not dissimilar.
I know I've heard stories like this before, and I wish I could remember like the actual source. But this idea of like breaking into someone's house and spending time in their space.
Right. Well, it's a creepy stalker thing, usually. Yeah, and Chungking Express is trying to make it kind of quasi-romantic.
If you ever saw the film 1 Hour Photo, there's a sequence where this guy breaks into this family's house and just like kind of looks through their stuff and uses their bathroom just because he likes being there.
The only way that Chungking Express can get away with that story without just being kind of terrifying is if Faye is seen as completely non-threatening. And I think that might contribute to some of that manic pixie dream girl energy you're going to, because he can't present her as any form of darkness without this story not being romantic at all.
It's not just the darkness. I see that it's kind of hard to project too many human qualities on her. I feel like the flight attendant has a lot more agency. She's the one who actually
It's not about agency. The whole point is she doesn't have agency. If she had agency, she'd just ask him out.
I suppose so. And
this is her tragedy. She can't do that.
Okay.
You know, why does she put on loud music? Because she wants to talk to people?
No.
Because she's good at communicating? No. She's bad at it. That's the point. So I like that story more than you, and I guess I've made my point. But I also know a lot of people who prefer the first story. Okay. So I totally get it.
Yeah, I like the first story a lot. I think there's just a lot of character and drive, and I think the quirk, I keep using the word quirk, just sort of like the unusual habits of the characters, feel a little bit more relatable in that first story.
Sure.
The second one, it feels a little bit too stylized for my taste.
It's funny to me because, like, you say, like, how relatable they are, and yet they're the ones who are, like, immersed like in this world of organized crime. Like, how relatable? Did something you want to tell me, Whitney? Because I relate far more to people who are lonely at restaurants.
Oh, well, I mean, if you need some heroin. I'm not really a drug dealer.
Wink. Anyway.
No wink. I'm not a drug dealer.
Anyway.
Wait a minute. You guys aren't cops, are you?
Your last, any last thoughts on Chungking Express? What'd you think?
I wish I liked it more. I don't dislike it, though. I would give this a recommend. I think people should see this movie.
Yeah, just did blow your mind.
I understand that it did blow a lot of people's minds. Yeah. It made its way into a lot of top 10 lists, but it also made its way kind of into the middle of a lot of critics. So you look it up on sort of like I looked it up on Rotten Tomatoes, and I think it has like an 80s%.
Yeah,
like, so it's not like unanimously beloved, but you know, it was a big boon in terms of its success for the way a lot of international cinema was going to be a lot more enthusiastically distributed in the following years.
Yeah.
And the 1990s were a pretty good time, especially when you look at kind of like a Miramax catalog of a lot of these films that were being imported to the United States. Miramax shaved them down and recut a lot of these movies.
Yeah, a lot of them pretty badly, too. And there are a lot of films that Miramax would acquire specifically to never release them, which is shit. And it wasn't until they started going under that these movies started getting Blu-ray releases finally, like classic Hong Kong movies. Like, it's just fucking crime what they did. But
I appreciate, I think it was Miramax that distributed Krzysztof Kieslowski's Three Colors in the U.S.
I think so, but I'm not 100% on that. Yeah.
I'd have to look that up. But I'm grateful for that because I love those movies.
Right.
Yeah, see the Three Colors, all three of them. They're great. And be sure to see them in order because they don't make sense otherwise. Blue, white, and red.
Okay. I think you can see red on its own. I think red works
feel,
on its own.
I feel like Chungking Express was really one of the things that sort of kicked the door open in terms of Quentin Tarantino being a little bit more of a cultural presence beyond the films he was making.
Yeah, he was more of a presenter.
Yeah.
Like, follow what Quentin Tarantino is doing. He will send you to good movies.
So, and again, I'm not giving any value judgments here. I'm just sort of saying things that happened.
That's just what it was like in the late
90s. He started his own video label. It was called Rolling Thunder Pictures. To start spreading around sort of his favorite movies.
And his second film he released, I believe, was Mighty Peking Man, which did not have the same cultural impact.
He also re-released Switchblade Sisters. Those are some of the
which
the
is a cool
titles.
Movie. Which is a cool
Switchblade
movie.
Sisters is pretty damn cool.
Yeah,
movie.
Pretty fucking awesome, actually.
Mighty Peking Man is absurd, but it's a lot of fun to watch.
It's fun, but it's not going to change your life.
It's a King Kong knockoff.
Yeah. Anyway, that is it for Critically Reclaimed. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next time on Critically Reclaimed, our poll over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork is going to be, hey, we're still in a romantic mood. We're going to do romance movies on Tubi. Tubi TV is typically perceived as the cult streaming service. They have a lot of rare, bizarre horror movies, sci-fi movies, action movies, westerns. And honestly, their selection is fucking phenomenal. Especially if you don't have like the highest possible standards. Like if you like schlock, they have much fun shit. But they also do have some respectable films. So we're going to go romance movies.
One in every 30 is a respectable movie.
We're going to go with some romantic movies that are available on Tubi, and you can vote for any of these, and we will review them on the next episode of Critically Reclaimed. The nominees are Cactus Flower, starring Goldie Hawn. I believe that's the one she won an Oscar for, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. Which was another 90s indie international darling.
It's about... It's like Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice.
Yeah, which is...
Eat and Drink and Man and Woman.
Yeah, then they all had sex. Then there was Girls Just Want to Have Fun, starring Sarah Jessica Parker and Helen Hunt. And dang it, they just want to have fun. They want to go on a dance show.
They just want to have fun.
Only.
Nothing else.
It's a little reductive if you think about it. And then lastly, the Anthony Hopkins, Emma Thompson, 1990s Oscar-winning drama, The Remains of the Day, which is one of the more excitingly understated movies you will ever see. I saw that movie when I was, like, whenever it came out. I guess it was, like, 13.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I don't understand any of this. he's a butler. She's kind of a butler.
I don't think
are they going to do anything? We're just going to chill here. And then I saw it again as an adult, and I'm like, oh, there's so much going on.
I would love to meet the 13-year-old who's really into The Remains of the Day.
Yeah, right? It's like specifically, it should be rated R just for like pacing. Yeah.
I remember this is something Roger Ebert said. He said the great irony of the R rating is that the bulk of R-rated movies appeal to people under 17.
Yeah.
It's like Remains of the Day is not rated R. That's going to appeal to adults. But, you know, A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5 is rated R. And
it's pretty ironic.
14-year-olds want to see that movie.
Quick correction. Remains of the Day did not win any Academy Awards. It was nominated for a bunch. I was thinking of Howard's End. That won Academy
Awards. That won
Awards.
Academy Awards.
Yeah. Which were kind of right back to back to each other. But anyway, that is it for Critically Reclaimed. Head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork if you want to vote in that poll. Thank you to all of our patrons for keeping this show afloat. If you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode, if you want to ask us questions, you want to critique our critiques.
Tell me how wrong I am about Wong Kar Wai, please.
Tell him how right he is. Just make him feel better. He's a good guy. You can email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail, or you can send us, if you're feeling very 90s, you can send us an actual letter, a physical letter, a piece of paper, or similar substance in the mail. You could do it on a napkin if you wanted, I guess. And yeah, Whitney, what
if
is...
If you send us a napkin, we're reading that crap.
We'll read anything we get in the mailbox, but what is our P.O. Box, Whitney?
Send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And of course, we're on Twitter, at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And until next time, this is how I end this podcast.